From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Well, first of all, we are wishing Art Bell a speedy recovery. He has been in the hospital with a severe bout of colitis. Not very good. So get well, Art. Speedy recovery there. And congratulations to Grandpa Dave Schrader, our fill-in host. His granddaughter Stella was born. Congratulations, David. You will love them. Well, as we reported last week, by the man you're going to hear in just a second, the Department of Homeland Security and a top cybersecurity firm have advised Windows PC users to uninstall Apple's QuickTime video player immediately after two new bugs were found in the software. In a blog, a company called the Trend Microsecurity Firm said that Apple was no longer issuing security updates for QuickTime for Windows, despite the presence of the bugs. Trend Micro said the bugs could be used to launch attacks on all PCs if users visit a compromised web page or even open a tainted file. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, who broke the story on our program last week. Well, Lauren, you were way ahead of the curve on that one, my friend.
Yeah, well, what's really sad about this case is that so many people have QuickTime on their PCs, and they probably don't even know it. Because QuickTime was very aggressively installed by Apple onto not just onto Apple systems, but onto Microsoft operating systems also. And in many cases, it kind of hid in the background because it was used to play video and audio in all kinds of different contexts.
Mm-hmm.
It's been passed by largely now. You virtually never see a modern program that uses QuickTime, but Apple continued pushing it onto these systems. And what's apparently happened now, as we've discussed, is that they're just not going to update it anymore. And since Homeland Security has announced some fairly serious bugs there, you know, that potentially could cause all kinds of problems.
Oh yeah.
The recommendation is that people take it off of their PCs, and that isn't necessarily so simple to do. So what I did a little earlier today is I put a link on my homepage that just says right in the middle of the page, it just says how to uninstall QuickTime. And that's at vortex.com, V-O-R-T-E-X.com. And you can go to that. You can look at the page of instructions and decide how you want to proceed. And there's more links from there. It's not something where you have to rush and figure this all out tonight. But getting QuickTime off of your system would be a good idea.
And if you have QuickTime, you can go to your programs and then it'll just show up that way?
Usually it will. But I suggest following the instructions that are at that link on my site, because you do have to be a little bit careful, because sometimes there are cases where QuickTime has kind of gotten intertwined with other programs, and if you don't follow exactly the right steps to uninstall, you might disrupt other programs, again, not even realizing that QuickTime was involved.
All right, Lauren, thank you, and thank you for breaking that story on our program national. We're way ahead by 2 days of everybody, thanks to Lauren Weinstein. Texas A&M University officials have cleared the way for concealed carry permit holders to cart their guns into classrooms with few major restrictions, according to the new policy. The chancellor there, John Sharp, in the A&M's systems legal team, gave the go-ahead for the policy switch. The only exceptions are certain spots at Prairie View AMN, Texas A&M International University, and A&M Corpus Christi, because they have dorms that are leased by third-party companies. At least one American was among 413 people confirmed dead from Ecuador's strongest earthquake in decades. The State Department says crews are racing to save anybody who still might be alive and trapped underneath the rubble. Very tragic situation there. It was a huge earthquake. And underneath Yellowstone National Park in Wyoming, Montana, and Idaho, as we've been talking about for years, there is a reservoir of magma that is more than twice the size that researchers previously thought. Now, this explodes, this caldera goes, every 640,000 years on average. It's way overdue. Let's check in with Cal Ori, the author of The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, a story about Jim Birkeland. And Cal knows earthquakes just as well as anybody. Does the caldera at Yellowstone scare you, Cal?
Now, I mean, every time you talk about it, it scares me, but you know me, I'm thinking more of the West Coast. from my favorite place where I always go, British Columbia, Washington, and of course where I live in California. It's the West Coast. You know, this is deja vu. Do you remember back in 2011, the Pacific Ring of Fireflakes, and Jim Berglund, he was on Fox News, and he said because in early 2011, Chile, New Zealand, and Japan all got hit, remember? And he got on Fox News, and he said he thought that North America was next, and the places I just discussed on the West Coast. Fast forward the past week, mm-hmm. we've had four major quakes, two Asia, two South America, and now researchers are saying if there could be something, you know, to remote triggering. The idea of a big quake, can it cause another quake thousands of miles away? Because these two quakes, Ecuador and Japan, they were more than 15,000 miles apart. But the scientists are saying, and I've got it right here, folks in California, Oregon, Washington should be prepared for a possible earthquake tonight.
Now you're scaring me.
Well, you're not on the West Coast.
Well, I will be in 2 weeks.
You'll be fine. Just
all right, Cal.
Jacket.
We're going to watch this. Cal Lurie, thank you so much. Oil prices slid on Monday after a meeting between major producing nations on a proposed output freeze fell apart, leaving the world grappling with an excess of unwanted crude. Truly an amazing story there. Tax time, of course. Millions of taxpayers facing a midnight deadline in some areas where millions of others were asking for a six-month extension. The filing deadline delayed 3 days beyond the traditional April 15th deadline because Friday was a legal holiday in the District of Columbia. So set aside what you think you know about yourself and microbes, because what you're about to hear, the hidden half of nature, will just astound you. That story is next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Fascinating couple hours we've got for you tonight. First of all, let me introduce two people, husband and wife team, and they are the author of The Hidden Half of Nature, David Montgomery, professor of geomorphology at the University of Washington, 2008 MacArthur Fellow. He's the author of Rocks Don't Lie and other award-winning popular science books, including the one we're going to talk about tonight. And Anne Biclay, of course, is a biologist and environmental planner. Her career spans the fields of environmental stewardship, habitat restoration, public health. Now, there was a very surprise cancer diagnosis that launched her and her husband David on a search for answers into the realm of human microbiome, and we'll have them explain what the heck that is too. But here's David and Ann. Welcome you two to the program.
Hey, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hello.
Hi, Ann. Hey, Ann, tell us about this cancer diagnosis and what led you and David onto this search. What happened?
Okay, yeah. Well, it was in 2011, and I got a phone call from my doctor, the kind you never, ever want to get, and I learned that I had a malignant cancer. And at the time, we were about halfway through writing this book, and the type of cancer that I had was caused by, of all things, a microbe, by a virus.
Jeez.
And we are, you know, neck deep into research for this book. And at that point, many of the things we had learned were largely about the good side of microbes. And then I get hit with this cancer diagnosis, at the root of which is a pretty nasty virus, the human papillomavirus. I had cervical cancer. And it gave us some real food for thought. The duality of the microbial world is really something to consider, because on the one hand, there's several microbes that can cause different kinds of cancer. But on the other hand, what we had done in our yard was watch the microbial world absolutely transform our soil as we were in the process of trying to create a garden.
Hmm. That's an interesting take. We'll get into that. And of course, David, explain to us, what is a microbe?
Well, you know, a microbe is the life forms that we can't see with our senses. So they're things that are invisible to us. So they're things like bacteria, fungi, protists, things that are smaller than about the tenth of a millimeter are going to be invisible to the naked eye. And so technically, those things are microbes. And it's a really rich and diverse world of organisms. Fully half of the nature that is on this planet is in that invisible world of the microbial world, which means we haven't known that they've existed for a long time, and we're still learning very fundamental new insights about how they interact with the nature that we do know.
And these microbes, they're alive, aren't they? Very much alive.
Well, yeah, you know, people argue about the viruses as to how to, the biologists will argue about how to classify them. Are they alive? Are they not alive? What are they? But yes, they are very much alive, and the roots of all higher life forms run back through evolutionary time back to the microbial world. They were the first life forms.
Now, when we talk about human microbiome, what's that?
Well, you know, the microbiome is the collection of microbes that are indigenous to another organism. So for the human microbiome, it's all the bacteria and the fungi and the protists that live on and within us. And you can think of your own body as a set of ecosystems for microbes. Different parts of your body will have different populations of native microbes. And we've been learning over the past few decades just how important some of the good ones are for our own health.
I am a walking supplement of all kinds of things, and I take probiotics, David, in hand. And apparently, I've been told over the years that probiotics will give you good bacteria. My question has always been, and you two are the best for this, what the heck is the difference between good bacteria and bad bacteria in your body?
Yeah, that's that is the question that we all want to know. Basically, the difference is that when someone says, oh, you want to have those good bacteria, what they're really saying is you want to have abundant and robust populations of such microbes, because they do all kinds of things for us, from producing, for example, vitamins. Vitamin K is one. They also produce some of the B vitamins. And what's very interesting is what good bacteria do down in the lowermost part of our digestive tract, in our colon. There, they actually digest the complex carbohydrates of the plant foods that are in our diet. And when they do that, which they do through a process called fermentation, their metabolic byproducts then start circulating throughout our body in our bloodstream, and they can have some medicinal effects. So this is sort of in a nutshell when someone says, oh, you want to get some good bacteria or good microbe, those are some of the reasons why. The bad microbe, on the other hand...
And do they all look the same?
No, they don't. A good bacteria can look just like a bad bacteria. So it's hard to tell on site alone, under a microscope, of course, whether something is good or bad. You really sort of need to get down to the genomic level or the molecular level to figure out what exactly are the compounds that these bacteria, good or bad, are producing in our bodies.
Okay, so the bad bacteria would do what to us?
Well, there's an example maybe some listeners may be familiar with. A bad bacterium is something called Clostridium difficile, and for short, people just call it C. diff. And this is a nasty bacteria that can take over, in numbers anyway, a person's portions of the small or large intestine. And what happens when you have too much of this C. diff, it produces a toxin that can permanently damage the lining of the small or large intestine. And once that happens, all kinds of other problems can occur.
Why can you kill bacteria with the right antibiotic, but you cannot kill a virus with an antibiotic?
Yeah, that sort of just has to do with their basic biology. They're completely different kinds of organisms. As Dave had mentioned, in fact, there's a lot of people don't even consider viruses alive.
Right.
And so that's one of the most fundamental differences between a bacterium and a virus, that viruses are basically just sort of packages of DNA. They don't need to eat. They don't really excrete any waste products. A bacterium, on the other hand, is as alive as you or me. It's doing the same kinds of things. Well, not exactly, but it's doing the basics.
But close. I mean, but it survives. It eats.
Yes.
Does it see? I mean, does it have eyes?
No, bacteria do not have noses, eyes, ears, anything like that. They do most of their sensing through receptors on their cell surface that are very sensitive to different kinds of chemicals.
Do they breed?
Yes, they do.
Huh.
Oh, yes. They can breed rapidly, let's say faster than bunnies, guinea pigs, and mice.
All right.
Much faster.
Now, and as far as a virus is concerned, let's bring you in on this, David, too. Does a virus multiply? Does it breed?
Yes, the way a virus multiplies is a virus particle will get into an organism, to the inside of an organism, and it will go directly inside of a single cell of that organism, and they will hijack the DNA of their host cell. That's the name for the organism that they've invaded is their host. Once a virus gets inside of a host cell, they sort of, as I said, they take over the DNA replication process of that organism, and they insert their own DNA pattern into that host cell, which then starts to churn out more viruses. And that's how virus multiplies inside of a person's body or a plant or what have you.
So when we hear about the AIDS virus, and now they're coming up with these cocktails to fight it and to, you know, kind of contain it. How do these drugs suppress a virus if really technically it's not alive but just a strand of DNA?
Yeah. Most of these drugs interfere in one way or another with the virus's ability to, you know, insert itself into the DNA replication process. And so if you can thwart that, if you can put some kind of a shield, picture it as some kind of a shield or barrier to that virus inserting itself into the DNA replication process. And so that then would, of course, reduce its numbers greatly. And if a virus can't produce more of itself, it just dies off and the numbers never get high enough in a host organism to do much harm.
Well, with David Montgomery and Ann Bickley, we're talking about their work, The Hidden Half of Nature, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. Tell me about the title, Ann.
Yeah, well, we both David and I are sort of come out of classic natural history disciplines. His is geology, mine is biology. And both of us have been trained to look at the parts of nature that we can see, that we can touch, that we can smell. You know, Dave picks up rocks. I'll, you know, pick up plants and look at birds through binoculars. And so while we're very, very familiar with those types of nature, when it came to our garden and when it came to us looking into what is really going on in the soil beneath our feet, much of that revolves around the microbial world. And so we came up with the title, the main title, The Hidden Half of Nature, just based on that. This is a part of nature that truly is hidden from, you know, being able to observe it with the naked eye. And then the subtitle, The Microbial Roots of Life and Health. As it turns out, you know, anyone who picks up the book from start to finish, they'll understand that subtitle by the end, but basically, we, a long, long, long time ago, you know, our ancestors, not human ancestors, but organisms that eventually led to humans, got their start when two microbial cells merged and thus started down the path of multicellular life, and it was built, you know, billions of years later that we finally came along. So that's the roots of life part. And when it comes to the roots of health, the microbiome of crops, of our plants, and the microbiome of people turns out to be absolutely fundamental to the health and well-being of plants and people.
All right, stay with us. We'll be back with both of you in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Fascinating. Welcome back to Coast, David Montgomery and Vic Lay with us. The book, The Hidden Half of Nature. David, the book is, it looks like it just came out.
Yeah, it came out late last fall, just right before Christmas, and it's been doing really well. I've been really happy with the reviews we've been getting from readers and from people in the microbiome field who know the science, and it's been doing great. It's a real eye opener. It's a different way of looking at the world, both around you and also within you. Because frankly, a lot of people haven't put a lot of thought into their microbiome. We didn't even know about it until a few years ago.
Out of sight, out of mind, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, we talk about the history of how people came to be aware of microbial life, some of the characters that were involved in their discovery, the important things that they laid down along the way, and how we kind of got it wrong for 100 years, looking at microbes through the lens that they were all pests and pathogens, when the vast majority of them are either sort of indifferent to us or beneficial to us, and the how to care and cultivate for the beneficial microbes that support the health of our crops that we depend on and our own health is a really brand new area that's changing thinking in both agriculture and medicine. And that's what got us really excited about pursuing the book the more we looked into it through the exploration of our garden and the NANS health challenges.
You're a professor of geomorphology. What is that?
Yeah, that's a lot of people have not heard that word, and you can dissect it into geo, it's earth, morphology is the form of things. So a geomorphologist studies the surface features of the earth. So 100 years ago, I would have been called a topographer.
And when you were talking about bacteria kind of merging together, then eventually life would pop and form, took billions and billions of years. Do you think it was by design?
Boy, I'm not sure how I think about that. I'd say it was certainly a it was something that worked. It was something that at the time worked out well for those single-celled organisms that decided, "Hey, I'm going to move inside of you, and that way, I'll have wheels because you're a much bigger microbe that has this little tail on you that can move us around, and I'm really efficient at, say, photosynthesizing, so I'll be our energy source." How that all came together, I think, is one of life's greatest mysteries.
Sure is. And then they picked up another one and another one. One probably said, "I can see better than you."
Exactly.
That is something else. It really is. When you look at a microbe under a microscope, what does it look like?
Well,
it's got little legs, or what does it look like?
Yeah, most bacteria underneath a microscope, there's a few basic shapes. Some are sort of shaped like a rod, so long and linear. Others are more round shaped. And this little tail-like thing that I referred to, that's called a flagella. Some bacteria have those, some don't. There's also bacteria that are shaped like a corkscrew, so like a spiral. And those are some of the main basic shapes. And then you'll see that some of them might have a different looking sort of texture on their surface than others. So it's sort of, I guess I would liken it to the way that when we look out on the visible part of nature and we see that a evergreen or a conifer has a certain kind of look and shape to it, and that like an oak tree or a maple tree has a certain look or shape to it. You can see some of those same basic differences, at least among, say, bacteria.
So my buddy here in St. Louis had a minor knee operation, and it flared up over the weekend. It got really big. It's hot. I think it's infected, definitely inflamed. What's happening in that knee, Ann, where there's got to be bacteria in there? What are they doing to cause that inflammation?
Yeah, well, inflammation, believe it or not, and my best thoughts to your friend, inflammation, believe it or not, is actually a good thing in this case. What it's doing is it's a healing process, and there's a whole bunch of different immune cells that are activated that are rushing to the site of this knee, and they're all of that heat and that swollenness and that redness, that's actually to try and keep, if there's any bad bacteria in there, those conditions will help to ensure that the bad bacteria don't get a leg up on the good bacteria.
And isn't it true, for example, when someone gets a fever, that's the body's way of fighting an infection?
That's exactly right, because, you know, there's a reason that, you know, our temperature normally is around 98.6, right?
Yeah.
And so a fever is a way of sort of burning out or killing off the infectious, the whatever bacteria are causing an infection, because you raise the temperature, you know, a degree until it gets maybe, you know, 101. That's quite a difference to a bacterium that's used to, you know, a nice comfortable 98.6.
So why do we take aspirin and drugs to reduce the fever when we should just let it do its thing?
Yeah, we should let fevers run so long as they don't get out of hand. The reason we take aspirin and those other things is because it feels pretty cruddy, and we want to, you know, we want to feel better. And so aspirin and so forth will dampen those symptoms, but in some cases, we really don't want to be dampening those symptoms.
I was going to say, in reality, we should just let the fever do what it's supposed to do.
Right.
How come sometimes they get so high? And as a parent, I used to remember us talking about our little kids, and you didn't want the fever to get like 104, 105. You panicked. You
right.
put them in the tub to cool
right.
them off when they got that high. Why does it get that high, and why is that serious?
Yeah, because when it gets, it's sort of like the Goldilocks. You want that temperature to go up just enough to kill whatever the pathogen is, but not so hot that it starts to damage, you know, the body's own tissue, which
okay.
can happen at, you know, 104 and so on.
What gets it to that higher fever rate?
Well, I think that's just our immune system, and the inflammatory response is going gangbusters. It's going a little
okay,
bit
okay, so your body's saying, we got to do this and do it fast, and it just goes into hyperdrive or something.
Yeah.
Okay, that's an interesting take on that. What do we learn by learning about microbes? What can we do to change our lives?
Well, that I'd say that's sort of been the question around our dinner table for the last several years.
Really?
Yeah. The more you learn about microbes, I think the more you can learn about yourself and about nature and how things are not always what they appear to be. So, you know, we were just talking about fever. I had a cancer caused by a microbe. Most of us, most of our lives, have been raised to think all microbes are all bad and they all cause disease. And in the process of doing the research for this book, and also through some lifestyle changes that we made, we are seeing the microbes in, you know, in another light as well, and that is that they can do some pretty neat things for us, and things that we absolutely have to have them doing for us as well.
If you were to look at, let's say, your desktop with a microscope, would you see these little microbes everywhere?
I'm afraid to say yes.
On our pillow, coming out of our mouths, everywhere, right?
Pretty much any surface anywhere and anywhere on Earth, whether, you know, below the bottom of the sea to the atmosphere they're blowing around. We've got microbes blowing into North America from Asia on a daily basis. We're covered with, you basically took all the sort of the plants and animals, including all the people in the world, just vaporized them and had a way to visualize the microbes that were left. You'd see the ghosts of all nature from our shroud of microbial life that we have. So they're pretty much everywhere, and that actually brings in this whole different perspective on looking at them, because there are so many of them that cover so many things that the idea that we've related to them with for the last century of trying to sterilize our environment and sort of, you know, kill all the microbes because they're germs and they're bad, it's not a strategy that's going to work over the long run. But if you start to see them as potential allies and figure out ways to enlist the good microbes or the beneficial ones on our side to help fight the ones that we can't actually see, it leads to very different strategies that have great pertinence for future developments in both agriculture and medicine.
All right, though, when you kiss somebody, how many microbes are you passing back and forth?
Well, it depends who you kiss.
But they're there.
Now, with the dog, I'd say probably on the order of at least hundreds of thousands.
Really?
And that's a speculative wild guess. We've actually never counted.
Keep the poochie away, huh? Jeez. Now, will a good microbe attack a bad microbe? Do they fight to the death?
Well, you know, there is competition and fights between microbes, but a lot of the ways that the good microbes actually benefit the health of their host organisms isn't so much from direct mortality of the bad ones as much as it is from elbowing them out and not allowing them a seat at the table. So imagine, uh-huh, let's say the root system of a plant. You know, this plant's growing in the soil somewhere, and it's going to be vulnerable to potential pathogens that could attack its roots and influence its health. And the plant can't run away from things that attack it. Its defenses are, it's stuck in place, so it's got to use chemical defenses. And there's a great conversation and relationships that happen between the plant through its roots to the microbes living in the soil, where plants actually will push out into the soil, you know, a quarter to a third of all those carbohydrates and organic molecules that they make through their monopoly on photosynthesis, where they can turn water and carbon dioxide from the atmosphere into new plant material. They'll push some of that stuff out into the soil through their roots to feed the good microbes and try and essentially breed a big community of them that will enshroud the roots and literally not leave pathogens with a way in by crowding them out. So you can think of them as sort of, you know, a little army of guards guarding a botanical castle around its roots.
And earlier, Ann, you were talking about gardening and microbes. What's the relationship there?
Well, I'd say this. The healthiest kind of gardens are going to be those that have plants rooted in soil that is just chock full of life. Microbial life, invertebrates that we can, you know.
But how do you know?
Oh, how do we know? Oh.
I mean, how do you know the soil has got what you need?
Yeah, that I partly, you know, we can't measure every absolute thing in our soil, and here's how I judge the health of our garden or other gardens that I see. And I'll look at the plants, and it's sort of like when you look at a person, you can sense, that person doesn't, you know, they've got a kind of a, their skin color seems a little odd for whatever their ethnicity may be. They're kind of walking a little slow. They got a limp. You can just tell when somebody's not quite healthy. And I have an eye for healthy and unhealthy plants in a garden. And the first thing I would do if I had a plant that was ailing is I would go take a look at the soil. And if I didn't find much visible to my eye, you know, I'm not seeing any earthworms, I'm not seeing, you know, certain kind of beetle, seeing all of these invertebrates, that tells me, okay, we're missing, if I'm not seeing that kind of life, that means that there probably also is not a good amount of life at the microbial level.
Because that kind of life wants to be in that kind of soil, right? The good stuff.
Right.
Yeah, and it often depends on the kind of habitat that you make in the soil, what kind of the conditions for it are. And you can think of if there's a healthy supply of the material that feeds the microorganisms that break down organic matter and that process the remains of once stuff that was once alive back into the raw materials that plants can take up to create new life. You know, those organisms are in the soil at low abundances if there's not much organic matter in the soil. If there's more organic matter, they start breaking that stuff down. They're the ones who multiply. So part of it is to cultivate and feed and try and promote the abundance of the beneficial microbes, at which will then outnumber and outcompete the pathogens and the pests.
So almost like the movie Field of Dreams, if you build it, they will come. If you put the right stuff in the soil, the microbes will show up.
Yeah, exactly, because there used to be a theory that sort of all the microbial life and the types of microbial life in the world were sort of everywhere, that everything was everywhere. But the new idea is that there's similar functional groups everywhere, but that the specific species are very adapted to particular plants and particular environments. So it is kind of like a modified build it and they will come.
How do they move around? Can they like travel distances? What's far for them?
Well, you know, you could think of our bodies as spaceships for microbes. So some of the most far-traveled microbes are the ones in animals. In terms of their own ability to travel, well, they're really tiny and they don't live very long. They can travel as a population by reproducing and moving, but their own mobility is relatively limited unless they have something like us to carry them around.
Would you say a microbe is a bacteria? Is that one and the same?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, microbe is just the general umbrella term for bacteria,
okay.
A virus, something like an amoeba, even fungi are considered microbes.
When they kill the microbes with antibiotics, now we're hearing resistant bacteria to antibiotics. What did they do to become resistant?
Well, yeah, bacteria are pretty clever. And what they do when they become resistant to something, it requires a little bit, not a lot of people realize this, but bacteria normally produce antibiotics in the soil. Those bacteria that are native to soil produce antibiotics. And the reason they do so is that it acts like a signal to other bacteria that they do not want to associate with. So it's a little bit like putting, you know, it'd be like walking through a crowd, you know, waving bright colored flags that are a signal to other people, hey, stay away from me, I'm making my way through here. In the soil, that is the purpose and function of antibiotics, it's how bacteria communicate with one another. It's like, this is my space here, and I'm going to hang out here, and so while I'm here, you know, you don't come over here. What we've done with antibiotics is that we have hugely concentrated their strength. Bacteria don't...
Hold on for a second, Ann and David. We're already at the top of the hour, but we're coming back for more.